Hello, and welcome to this PERspectives Continuing Education Podcast, created by healthcare professionals for healthcare professionals. PER is a leader in healthcare education and offers free accredited medical education programs in a variety of accessible formats at gotoper.com.
So my name is Eli Anto. I'm the Director of Educational Strategy here at PER. I want to thank and introduce our chair, Dr. Eden Stein, who's going to be leading the session this evening. He's contributed a ton of time and has worked effortlessly in crafting this program.
So I just want to make a couple of comments. So number one is, thank you all for coming. I'm joined by Dr. Levavi and Dr. Kremenskaya. So the first thing we're going to do is I'm going to introduce Dr. Levavi, who's going to give us an update and chat with us about therapy-related acute myeloid leukemia.
So I'll start with a patient case. This is a 72-year-old man who was diagnosed with prostate cancer in the past and had radiation 4 years ago, and presented with a new diagnosis of AML in the setting of 1 year of progressive cytopenias. His cytogenetics were consistent with the deletion in 7, and molecular profiling showed mutations in BCOR, DNMT3A, and IDH2. So during this talk, I'm going to talk about the evolving diagnosis and classification of therapy-related AML, review the treatment options in patients who are eligible for induction, for intensive induction, and those who are not eligible for intensive therapy. So I thought it was interesting when I was asked to talk about this entity of therapy-related AML, because this therapy almost, this classification almost doesn't exist anymore. In 2022, we had 3 new classifications for myeloid diseases. The World Health Organization, the ELN, and the ICC all came out with their own classification guidelines. And in each of these, there was some modification or a nuanced approach to how we discuss patients who have AML and had preceding cytotoxic therapy. So the World Health Organization, which in 2016 had a designation for therapy-related myeloid neoplasms, changed that name to myeloid neoplasms post-cytotoxic therapy. The ELN had a designation for therapy-related myeloid neoplasms that it changed, that it actually eradicated and designated therapy-related as a diagnostic qualifier to other more precise classifications. And the ICC came out with the same use of therapy-related as just a diagnostic qualifier. So in the World Health Organization classification, this myeloid neoplasm post-cytotoxic therapy falls under the category of, falls within this broad classification of secondary myeloid neoplasms. And they changed the wording to reflect this improved understanding of the risk that clonal hematopoiesis plays. And then in the ELN, as you can see, there's this more hierarchical way that we classify AML. And then at the very bottom, therapy-related is this diagnostic qualifier to these other cytogenetic and molecular-based classifications. And they make it very clear in the text of these guidelines that therapy-related is really not the primary defining feature of this disease, but that the genetic aberrations should take precedence. And the same exists in the ICC, where therapy-related is a qualifier. So even though we're not really using this term as the most precise way to define patients' diseases, we do know that there are some distinct features of patients who develop AML after receiving cytotoxic therapy, whether cytotoxic therapy or radiation. And we know, if you look at the figure on the left, if it's not too small to read, we know that there are very distinct and recurrent both molecular and cytogenetic features that occur when patients received prior therapy. So P53 alterations are very common, as well as these other alterations that can be linked to certain therapies. So we see a lot of deletion 5 and deletion 7, as well as KMT2A rearrangements. and other common molecular findings. We do know that therapy-related AML is associated with a worse prognosis, and this was an interesting study in 2020 where they looked at the small portion of patients who have therapy-related AML and actually have a normal karyotype. And they compared patients with therapy-related AML and patients with non-therapy-related AML, all of whom had a normal karyotype. And the overall survival and relapse-free survival for those who had therapy-related or had had prior therapy was still lower, even though these patients had a normal karyotype, and I didn't put it on here, but they had similar rates of other molecular abnormalities. And then you can see in this curve that the therapy intensity did not affect overall survival in those who had therapy-related AML with a normal karyotype. So I'm going to talk first about the treatment of patients who are eligible for intensive induction. And even though I just kind of talked down about the idea of therapy-related AML as its own distinct entity, a lot of these studies, or the main study that I'll present, did use this as a category. So I think a lot of you are probably familiar with CPX351. This is a liposomal version of 7-3, essentially. It's a 1-5 molar ratio of daunorubicin and cytarabine that's delivered within a small liposome. And the thought is that this will, the thought when this was developed is that it would target the bone marrow preferentially and reduce some of the toxicity and also be more selective to the abnormal bone marrow cells while not affecting the normal progenitors as much. So CPX351 was compared to 7-3 in this seminal trial that was published several years back. So this included 309 patients, with 63 of whom had therapy AML, therapy-related AML. So in the earlier trials of CPX351, there was actually a negative trial, but they noted that in a subgroup, patients with secondary AML actually did better than the rest of the population and seemed to have an improved outcome. So they conducted this trial of all secondary AML patients. I forgot to mention that before. And 63 of these secondary AML patients had therapy-related AML. So in the trial, patients received 1-2 induction cycles of CPX351 followed by consolidation cycles. And in the it's notable that patients who received 7-3 in the control arm, their consolidation was further cycles of daunorubicin and cytarabine. And so you can see here in this bar graph that patients in the dark blue who received CPX351 had improved remission rates, and then in this intention to treat analysis, the survival was improved in the CPX351 patients. And then you can see here among all the different types of AML that included people who had progressed from MDS or things like CMML, the patients who had therapy-related AML had a very clear benefit from CPX351. There is toxicity to this therapy. Different from 7-3, there was actually more cytopenias with CPX351 with an increase in about 7 days in recovery of both neutrophils and platelets, and there was an increased, significantly increased rate of bleeding events, though there were no grade 5 bleeding events in the CPX arm, and there was no difference in the early mortality with CPX. And then when we look at 5-year survival data, the improvement in survival with CPX remained even with this longer follow-up. So despite the excitement over this drug, there are some real-world data that call to question how effective it is. So first of all, I think not in all subtypes is this such a panacea. So in P53 mutated patients, these are some of the hardest to treat patients until Dr. Stein's new P53 modifier comes out, but we know that these patients are really, really difficult to treat, and as with almost all of our other therapies, patients with P53 mutations with CPX did poorer, both in terms of their remission rates and the achievement of MRD negativity. And then there was an interesting abstract that was presented that looked at the overall survival in patients who received CPX versus 7 and 3 with a HiDAC consolidation, which is really the standard of care that we use in most patients outside of the trial setting. And at least in this abstract, there was no difference in the overall survival between CPX patients and 7 and 3 patients. Of course, that wasn't a trial. This is a retrospective analysis. There are biases in terms of who received each therapy, but I think there's a lot to be learned exactly about where CPX351 should fall into our treatment algorithms for therapy-associated AML. So there's less clear data for what to do with patients who are ineligible for intensive induction. So I think everyone's also familiar with the VIALE-A trial that looked at azacitidine and venetoclax compared to azacitidine alone. And within this trial, 25% of patients had secondary AML. It's not clear exactly how the therapy-associated AML patients did within that category of secondary AML, but we do know that there were a number of therapy-associated AML patients who were included. And just among the cohort of patients with secondary AML, there was a CR/CRI rate of 67% in the AZA-VEN arm compared to 23% in the AZA arm alone. So we do see that secondary AML does benefit, as does the rest of the population in the study, from the addition of venetoclax to azacitidine. And then the overall survival in the with AZA-VEN compared to azacitidine alone was better with within this cohort of patients. And so just on the same topic of what the role is of CPX351 in these patients, this was an interesting retrospective study of CPX351 versus HMA venetoclax. And at least in this study, which again has all the caveats that we give to retrospective data, there was no difference in survival in patients who were treated with each therapy. But transplant did improve overall survival regardless of the treatment. So to summarize, therapy-related AML is becoming a retired term, even though we do know that these patients do share some cytogenetic and molecular features. Now we're increasingly using cytogenetics and molecular abnormalities to define AML, but having had prior therapy is an independent risk factor for a poor prognosis. We know that CPX351 is an effective treatment and it's approved in patients with secondary AML, but unfit patients and possibly even not unfit patients can be treated with HMA venetoclax-based therapy. And I do think that there are still a lot of questions out there in terms of the role of CPX351. So back to our case, I'm curious what others might do with this patient, how you might treat him. Just for background, this is a real patient. I modified it a little bit, but he was a real patient, very fit, worked in textiles, would travel to Australia frequently, just a very robust person to start with.
Okay, so the question is, how would we treat this patient? Marina, do you want to, what would you do?
So I tend to go to AZA-VEN route in these patients. Typically, so he's in his 70s, fit, but still, you know, a little bit older, and secondary AML. So I think this is something that he's likely going to be able to tolerate and potentially is going to have an excellent response and potentially could still go to transplant. So that would be my approach.
Does it give you any pause that we don't have? So the CPX351 data, there is this post-transplant data that shows this, you know, large delta between 7 and 3 and CPX351. And I think there's definitely less data with Aza Ven, does that influence things? I mean, it sounds like it doesn't influence things much, but.
I think that would still, you know, we still know that these patients can successfully go to transplant and potentially be cured. So I think that is probably still the approach I would choose, though I think the other one is also reasonable.
Okay, so what did you do?
Yes, yeah, so he actually did get CPX351, and he had a semi-complicated course. He had bacteremia and enterocolitis, and then he had very prolonged cytopenias. He had a bone marrow biopsy at the, you know, after giving him a little extra time to try to recover, but he still had 30% blast, which was a partial response compared to 85% at diagnosis. He then received one cycle of Aza-Ven and then underwent a transplant, and he's doing very well.
So is this your patient?
So it's actually Dr. Mascarenhas' patient.
Okay, so I have a question for you, because Dr. Mascarenhas isn't up here. So what was the decision? So Marina said she would have done Aza-Ven. So what would have pushed you to do CPX351?
I think the decision was based on how good looking he was as a 72-year-old, and we knew that based on his, you know, it was clear that he had probably progressed from some form of MDS even before we had the cytogenetics, but very quickly we realized he had a high-risk AML, and we wanted to just get him into a quick remission and then get him to transplant. But, you know, I'm not surprised he had such a good response to Aza-Ven with his IDH1 mutation.
Right.
But we were able to get him there, but unclear in retrospect, you know, I think what Dr. Kremyanskaya mentioned was that would have been a completely valid treatment option for the patient.
So then one last question, which is, so the decision was made after one cycle of induction, he had almost a partial remission, it looks like, and the decision was made not to give a second cycle of CPX, but to give a cycle of Aza-Ven. And this is something I know I struggle with all the time, because you've got a patient who had a tough time in the hospital, obviously. What do you do? Do you stick with, you know, sort of what you're supposed to do per the trial, or do you switch? And is that what happened here, or?
I think it was based mostly on how long he was in the hospital with these infectious complications. And he did have a partial response, but when you have this other option that you can administer outpatient, there was, you know, enough molecular information there to suspect that he would have a good response, and we didn't want to debilitate him further before trying to get him to transplant.
Okay, great.
I'm curious how often you actually do that second cycle of CPX in patients who don't fully respond, or even in responders as a consolidation, because it is really not the, you know, paradigm that we have for AML.
Right. So what I do is in patients who, I'm very conservative. So I try to stick to the protocol, but I try to give a reinduction with CPX351. In this guy, I wouldn't have for the reasons that you just brought up. I think the other piece of it is that for consolidation and someone who's going to go off to transplant, I actually do give I actually stick to the CPX351 consolidation, and then I transplant them. If I'm not going to transplant them, then I might switch to HIDAC based on nothing other than my own fully diagnosed anxiety. So,
you mean anxiety about not giving intensive
not
treatment
giving
and giving
high dose cytarabine. Uh-huh. Right, I've got this belief that high-dose cytarabine is magic when it comes to consolidation. So it looks like John has a...
Just a question, Eitan, for you. So at Memorial, so there's a big price differential between 7 and 3 and CPX351 Vyxeos. And when you give it in the hospital, there's a different impact to the institution than if you administer it as an outpatient. So how does it work at your institution, considering all the competing factors?
Yeah, so we tried to develop a program where we gave induction CPX351 as an outpatient. Days 1, 3, 5 outpatient, they would come in daily, and then I think at day 7 or day 14 or something, they got admitted. There is like retrospective data looking at this, as you know, that shows it can be done safely. But the logistics of it, at least, it's probably the same for you, is like, people don't live so close to MSK, and then, you know, where are they going to stay? And we have nowhere for them to stay. And it becomes, so we end up admitting them. And I have not yet gotten the bill, although one day I will.
I think that's what we actually did for this patient. He received the therapy outpatient, then he got admitted afterwards. But yeah.
And this works well if they're seen as outpatient initially, but if they're already admitted, as they often are, because they're present with new diagnosis of AML, then we have a problem with figuring out how to do this exactly.
Right, because no one wants to be, in my experience, no one wants to be discharged.
Right.
Yeah, like, what are you talking about? And you're going to watch me closely, and now you're going to send me home, so people are nervous. Okay, that was great. Thank you so much. We're going to move on to hear Dr. Kremenskaya speak about IDH1 mutated acute myeloid leukemia.
Okay, so first I will admit that this may not be real cases, but maybe they are. So 78-year-old woman, newly diagnosed AML, so she has a history of hypertension, AFib, arthritis, ECOG performance status of 1. She was actually coming in for a hip replacement due to severe pain that was limiting her walking. And when she got her labs checked, she had neutropenia and anemia, was referred to hematology. And the bone marrow biopsy showed 35% blast, hypercellular marrow, and she had trisomy 8, IDH1, and DNMT3A mutation. FLT3 was wild type. So I think, this is happening again. What I see here and what is there is not the same.
I know they're not. I think the issue is that the iPad at the podium is not being synced with what we're seeing on the.
It is now, but I'm trying to go back. Can we go back to the original slide? It's slowly going back here, but not there.
That's how you want to be on.
It's the like there's like the choices. Oh, one more.
One more.
Okay, there. It's not the same here.
Is there a way you guys can sync the cut? The
there it is. Okay. It's not. I guess the slide is not that important, but I wanted to point out that we have a number of treatment options here. So we have an older patient with comorbidities, but decent performance status, and she has an IDH1 mutation. So these are potential treatment choices that I was thinking would be appropriate, could be appropriate for a patient with this profile, some more than others probably. So maybe. Maybe this could be where I would ask my colleagues what they would choose to do in this for this patient. Hannah.
The screen wasn't up when you were reading the case. Can you go back to it? I don't remember the.
So I'll summarize it. It's a 78-year-old woman with AFib, osteoarthritis, hypertension. She came in because she had, she was going to go for hip replacement. Blood counts were abnormal, so she has AML. She has IDH1 mutation and DNMT3A mutation, wild type FLT3.
I think I would start with HMA then, knowing that she would likely have a good response with the, since patients with IDH mutations tend to, and then reserve an IDH inhibitor for relapse or IDH inhibitor combination.
Doctor. You see the most of these patients.
I mean, I've become a fan of HMA Ivo, especially in patients where I'm worried a little bit more about myelosuppression. It sounds like she's, I don't know, maybe not the most robust person. And so I would probably start with HMA Ivo. I don't do triplets out of the gate.
Thank you. Yes, I think that would have been, probably would have been my choice. My choice probably would have been to start with HMA Van, but I was thinking of her as a little bit more robust. But I guess it depends on your evaluation of the patient. So first, you know, we're going to look at the famous VIALE-A study, and specifically focusing on IDH-mutated patients. And so I think it's pretty well known at this point that these patients tend to do very well with AZA-VEN and with improved responses and improved overall survival. And IDH2 patients tend to do better than IDH1 patients, but both do well. So I think this would be a good choice. But let's say this patient was less robust or had social issues that really wasn't able to come in for all the potential transfusions that she's going to need with venetoclax, and we wanted to sort of give her perhaps a less myelosuppressive regimen. So this is the results from the AGILE study, which looked at the combination of AZA plus IVO, masitinib, versus AZA plus placebo as an upfront therapy for patients with IDH1 mutations. And so there was a significant improvement in event-free survival, and there is an improvement in long-term overall survival for this combination. So I think, and this combination is certainly much less myelosuppressive than AZA-VEN combination. So I think for someone who we really worry about the myelosuppressive effects of venetoclax, an older patient, perhaps more comorbidities, this would be a great choice. And then this is summarizing this result. So CR was about 29% with CRH of another 14%, and the duration of response was pretty reasonable, what we would expect in this situation. So I'm just going to quickly show the triplet study. I don't think most of us are doing this yet, but so we know that AZA-VEN is active in this patient population. We also know that we can have additional responses with the addition of the targeted agent. And so could we get better, deeper responses with the triplet combination? And you know, hopefully the answer is yes. It would need to be done in the right setting for the right patients, but this is a big study that looked at different cohorts of patients with different doses of venetoclax and also different diseases, including MDS. But you can see here that responses specifically with the triplet and the VEN of 400 were pretty good. And for those patients that achieved IDH clearance or that were negative for MRD by multicolor flow, the overall survival was really very excellent. So I think this is something that we're probably going to see more in the future. So now we have a newly diagnosed patient who is 55, so younger, and really in great shape, not taking any other medications, no other past medical history. And she presents also with IDH1 and DNMT3A mutations. FLT3 is wild type. And so this is the combination of, so this patient would be eligible and probably would be a good choice for induction therapy with 7+3 or whatever other induction regimen people are using, with a combination of either IDH1 or IDH2 inhibitor. And you know, the results are looking pretty good here with the CRs of 71 and 56%, and the 12 months overall survival of 79 and 75%. So not approved in the setting right now, but something that is potentially, again, going to be something that we could do in the future. Next case is a 75-year-old man. Performance status is zero. Has, I see a theme here, sorry, IDH1 and DNMT3A mutation. He was initially treated with induction chemotherapy and consolidation. And then he presents 6 months after completion with relapse. He's then treated with AZA-VEN for 11 cycles with CRI achieved after 2 cycles. He declined stem cell transplant.
and now comes with relapse disease again. IDH1 mutation is present, no other targetable mutations. So now we're looking at IDH1 inhibitors in the setting of relapse disease, and so this is the original study that actually led to its approval in this setting, using avacitinib in relapse refractory AML, with the CR/CRh rate of 32%, and the duration of response of about 8 months, and the CR rate of 24%. So active in this setting, the duration of response is not very long, but potential for response and potential for maintaining these patients or potentially getting them to transplant in the right setting. So the next drug we're going to talk about is alemtuzumab, which is another potent IDH1 inhibitor. And this was studied in this phase 2 study, and specifically looking in a cohort of patients here with relapsed refractory AML who have not been exposed to IDH inhibitor. And here the CR is 32% with CR and CRH of 35%. An overall response rate of almost 50%. So again, in this relapsed refractory setting, pretty decent responses as monotherapy. And what Dr. Stein pointed out earlier today is that for whatever reason, this particular study had very impressive median duration of CR/CRh of almost 26 months, something that we really don't see in this setting of relapsed refractory AML. What was also notable in this study is that many patients who were transfusion dependent for both red blood cells and platelets became transfusion independent on treatment with this agent. So significant improvement potentially in patients' quality of life. So just comparing the two drugs, I think they're pretty similar in terms of effectiveness. The major difference seen here, again, we're not supposed to compare different studies, but we're doing it, is the duration of response. It seems to be longer in the olutumab arm. And this is looking at the updated response, five-year update. And for those patients that are responders with CR/CRh, they're doing really, really well. And so in terms of adverse events, as expected, there are some LFTs abnormalities, more so in olu arm, and QTc prolongation is more significant in the ivo arm. But otherwise, they're pretty similar, with differentiation syndrome seen in both arms at, I think, about the same rate. So this study also included combination therapies in relatively small numbers of patients with azacitinib. And so for those patients that did not have prior exposure to HMA or IDH, the overall response was about 60%. And the response was also in the 60% with those patients that had treatment-naive AML. In the very small number of patients that are shown here that have previous IVO exposure, there was a small number of patients that achieved CR, and one of these patients was able to proceed to transplant. So I think this is important and to be seen with more data is how to sequence these agents potentially. And also in those patients that have previously been treated with venetoclax, again, these are relatively small number of patients here, but a little bit more here. 26 patients, 6 patients achieved CR. So again, and as one patient achieved CRH, 2 patients achieved CRI, so we're seeing some responses. So in conclusion, In IDH1 and IDH2 mutated AML, additional treatment options are not available. I think we have to figure out what are the appropriate combinations, at what point of patient's treatment, and how to sequence them best. And additional combination studies are ongoing. Thank you.
One quick question for both of you. IDH1 mutant 78-year-old, Aza-Ven or Aza-Ivo in general?
I think it depends on how robust they are.
Okay.
And how much I expect them to come in. They're going to be able to do what's expected for them to do with Aza-Ven. So I think either one.
Yeah, I agree. I think in the question that you asked initially, there was a note that the patient's ECOG performance status was 1, so that was kind of what I used to decide Aza-Ven. But yeah, I think it depends on how much you think that they're going to tolerate cytopenias from Aza-Ven.
Okay.
Can I ask you guys a question?
Yes.
Okay. When would you use a triplet therapy up front? And in a patient who you think could tolerate a triplet therapy, how would you decide between that and intensive induction?
I would never use a triplet therapy up front. I think that although the data is impressive, it's extremely small numbers. And I worry a lot that you're adding a lot of financial toxicity, right? So the combined cost of Ven plus an IDH inhibitor is $50,000 a month, or in that range to, our insurance. And I'm not totally convinced that it's that much better than the doublet. So I have not used triplets. Although we have trials of triplets, but not off-label.
Yeah. Sorry, John, just want to add that we often, when we start this therapy, especially again for patients that are admitted because they're newly diagnosed and admitted, we don't have the IDH mutational status. And so we often start Aza-Ven. And then if they're doing well, then just continue it. That's kind of has been my approach.
So the question back to Eitan for the same question you were asking the group, which we talk about, I feel like, at almost every leukemia tumor board, well, at least once a month. You have the IDH1 mutated AML patient. Do you go with the HMA-Ven or HMA, IDH inhibitor up front? So in my mind, if you use HMA-Ven, you can always use your IDH inhibitor either alone or in a combination on the back end to salvage the patient eventually. But just talk to me about, what about the concept? Do you use IDH1 inhibitor up front? Are you burning that resource too early and losing the opportunity to use it somewhere in the line of therapy?
Yeah, no, I think it's a concern. I think, there's this emerging data that maybe you are sort of burning your bridges. Again, the numbers are really small from the data sets that are out there. So I don't have a great answer. I haven't stopped using it because I'm worried I'm burning my bridges, because I think most people will go into remission. There is this more for the audience than maybe these folks, but there is a randomized study now of HMA-Ven versus HMA-Ivo that's being done out of Ohio State from, I think it's being funded by an R01 grant. And I think if you are on the HMA-Ven arm and then you progress or don't respond, you can cross over to the other arm. So if that trial can get accrued, that will be helpful, I think.
And do we know, are IDH1-driven leukemias that relapse after BCL2 inhibition biologically any different than before seeing a Ven? Is there any reason to think that the activity of an IDH1 inhibitor would be different after Ven exposure?
So biologically, I can't, I can't give you a good preclinical hypothesis why that would be true, but I think clinically it might be true, and there's probably something there.
Okay, thanks.
I mean, one thing that we're doing, so, there's a lot, I think a lot of us feel that we give too much Aza-Ven, right, Aza-Ven forever. So we actually have, if you guys want to participate, we'd love to have you aboard, but it's, we just got an IIT approved of HMA-Ven induction, oh no, HMA-Ven-Ivo induction for up to 3 cycles, and then once you get into remission, Ivo maintenance from then on out. So dropping the intensive part of the treatment, maybe it'll be better, maybe it won't be better. But we can talk afterwards. Hopefully you want to help us out.
Yeah.
How much van?
How many days?
You know, 400, but we shorten the duration rapidly. I go from 20, so I do 28 days during cycle one. Some people do 21 days, I do 28. And then, but once someone's in some sort of remission, I drop it to 14 immediately, and then I drop it to 7. And then often, I mean, I'm sure you've had this experience, sometimes I have to even like go to 6 to 8 weeks and then drop, sometimes I drop the AZA to 50 per meter squared. I mean, it's a real mess, so. And with that, describing a mess, this is less of a mess. So this is NPM1 mutated and KMT2A rearranged acute myeloid leukemia. Here's our case, 71-year-old woman with AML associated with a 9/11 translocation, which is a KMT2A rearrangement. And apparently she also has an NPM1 mutation, which never actually happens, but okay. Comes to my office for a second opinion about the best treatment option for relapse refractory AML. She got 7 and 3, got a CR, got a transplant, relapses 10 months post-transplant. We're going to talk briefly about menin inhibitors. I showed this slide in the earlier session describing that menin is an adapter protein that needs to latch on to the MLL complex in order to propagate leukemias. And if you block that interaction of menin and the MLL complex, you can get downregulation of Hox genes and a reemergence of myeloid differentiation. I showed you before these different compounds, the IC50 curves of the various compounds that are in clinical development. We talked about how on the right-hand side, there was a compound from Biomea Fusion that doesn't seem to be inhibiting the menin-MLL interaction. And then I also showed this slide, and I'm just going to not repeat it all here, but just to summarize it, where between all the menin inhibitors, the overall response rates are relatively high in the 60% range. The complete remission and CRH rates combined are relatively lower in the 20 to 30% range. And the median duration of response is 6 to 8 months. The big toxicities of these drugs are as follows. They all cause differentiation syndrome. Some of that differentiation syndrome has been fatal, even in the presence of steroid use. So Kura Oncology was put on an FDA hold because of a steroid refractory death, and there was a death on another study as well. And then a couple of the agents lead to QT prolongation, although that QT prolongation doesn't seem to be much worse than what we see with other agents like FLT3 inhibitors and ivosidenib, which also prolongs the QT. So why do patients relapse so quickly? So we know the answer, we think, based on data that was published last year with revumenib. And that is that there are patients who develop resistance mutations that block the binding, in this case of revumenib, and its ability to bind into that menin pocket. These are three cases of patients treated at Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center where you can see that the patients had an initial response, then subsequently relapsed relatively rapidly. The maybe unfortunately impressive thing is that in this data set that we looked at, of the 40 patients, I think there are 40 patients there, of the 40 patients that were analyzed, no, they're not 40 patients, they're 31 patients. Of the 31 patients that were analyzed, 40% of those patients, or close to 40%, had a resistance mutation that emerged relatively rapidly while on therapy. It's important to note that not all of these patients relapsed. Some of these patients had the mutation, went on to transplant, and were potentially cured, but mutational resistance arises rapidly. You will see other companies, some of which may be in this room, that will say we do not have any issues with menin inhibitor resistance. That may or may not be true, but I think the thing that you have to look at really closely is what assay are they using to look for the menin resistance mutation. The assay we used here was an extremely sensitive digital droplet PCR assay, where if two or more droplets were positive for the mutation, we called it as mutation positive. I think other assays that are being used are much, much less sensitive, and I suspect that some of those mutations that are being not discovered from other compounds might actually be there. And this just shows a ribbon plot of how the mutation blocks the binding of revumenib into the binding pocket. Okay, so how do we overcome that resistance? This is a trial that I did not talk about at the prior session called the SAVE trial. SAVE is being run and led by a talented young investigator at MD Anderson named Gus Issa. Gus put together a trial for relapsed and refractory KMT2A rearranged and NPM1 mutant and NUP98 rearranged acute myeloid leukemia, and it's giving these patients with relapsed and refractory disease an all-oral triplet, revumenib, what's known as decitabine and cedazuridine, I'm not allowed to say the commercial name, decitabine and cedazuridine, and then venetoclax, given as an all-triplet therapy. And what you can see in the results that have been presented to date is that in a small number of patients, 9 patients, the overall response rate is 100%. The rate of CR and CRH is 44%. The rate of CR is 33%. And of the patients who have achieved a CR or a CRH, all of those patients were MRD negative by multi-parameter flow cytometry. The J&J drug is doing a similar thing with their menin inhibitor called bleximenib. So this is a little bit of a complicated slide, but the basic idea is that they're combining their menin inhibitor, bleximenib, with ven-aza for patients with relapsed and refractory acute myeloid leukemia with a KMT2A rearrangement or NPM1 mutation. This is the study schema. The patients get a ven ramp up. They get 7 days of aza. The bleximenib starts at cycle 1, day 4. Now, when you look at the clinical activity, and here they're defining clinical activity only in 34 patients. So when you look at the J&J trials, they do a lot of acrobatics with what patient population they're looking at. So this is not the entire patient population. This patient population is the 34 patients who were at a dose of the drug that J&J thought was an effective dose of the drug. So they've circumscribed who they're looking at. Be that as it may, the overall response rate amongst both KMT2A and NPM1 mutant patients is 79%, with a CR-CRH rate of 24% and a morphologic leukemia-free state rate of 38%. So again, relatively high response rates in patients getting a triplet of a menin inhibitor with HMA-VEN in the relapsed and refractory setting. This is the trial I showed you previously for newly diagnosed AML patients with a KMT2A rearrangement or NPM1 mutation being treated with the triplet of Rev-Ven-Aza. I saved the best slide for last. The slide I showed previously was an earlier iteration of the results. These are actually the more updated results from EHA, I think it was EHA 2024. And what I showed you before, I think, was only 9 patients. What I'm showing you now is 26 patients. So the median age of these patient population was 70 years old. You can see that 17 of the patients were NPM1 mutated. I'm looking at the last column. 9 patients were KMT2A rearranged. Of the NPM1 mutated or KMT2A rearranged patients, 5 patients had a co-occurrent FLT3 internal tandem duplication. What are the results of the patients treated on this study? Well, you can see the composite CR rate, the so-called CRC, is 96%, with 69% of the patients achieving a complete remission, 8% of the patients achieving a CRH. The overall response rate is 100%. The MRD negative CR rate is 92%. Now, if I was looking at this, I would say, wow, this is amazing data. We should be doing this for everybody. But you got to look at the details, and the details are disturbing. Because if you look at the far right bottom cell, you can see that the death rate on study is nearly 25%. So it's a little bit strange that you have 100% of patients going into remission, but 25% of patients are dying while on study. And we know that of those that died while on study, 13% relapsed. So you could say something like, well, 13% of the patients relapsed relatively rapidly and they die because they relapsed, But what about that other 10% of patients? And what I worry about is that the way these drugs are being given is they're being given, I believe, at full dose, the ven and the aza and the revumenib for a prolonged period of time. And I suspect what you're getting is prolonged myelosuppression that while you might get into an initial remission, ends up leading to a toxic death. And I think this study needs to be, the schedule of the drugs being administered is gonna need to be modified in order to really keep that remission rate and keep that rate of response high without getting toxic deaths. The other interesting question is, why are these patients relapsing? Are they developing resistance mutations even though they are no longer just on a monotherapy with a menin inhibitor? That is, can resistance arise when there's a triplet and not only where there's revumenib or other menin inhibitor monotherapy? And with that, I thank you very much. We have about 5 minutes left, so I think one of the things I'm gonna do for the 5 minutes is I'm going to ask some questions. So, to our esteemed panelists, one question I have is, you know, revumenib is supposed to be approved by the end of December. It will be approved for, if it's approved, it will be approved for KMT2A rearranged acute myeloid leukemia. If you have a relapsed and refractory NPM1 mutant patient, will you try to get revumenib off-label to treat that NPM1 mutant patient?
I think it depends on what other treatments they've had, but yes.
Yes, okay. You do the same thing.
Yeah, yeah, depending on, I mean, I might sequence it after, you know, if they're, they just relapsed, they're in, you know, first relapse.
And what about if you had a patient who had a co-occurring NPM1 mutation and FLT3 mutation that had relapsed? How would you sequence giving gilteritinib or some other FLT3 inhibitor with revumenib? What would you do first?
So actually, I was going to ask you that question.
Or would you just put them together and like hope for the best?
Yeah. So both of these are presumably sort of leukemia, important mutations for leukemia progression. So I don't know which one should go first. Probably yeah, would want to combine yeah. them, but I think we're not quite there.
Yeah, I mean, like gilteritinib, for instance, and the menin inhibitors don't have sustained responses, so some sort of sequencing. I don't think there's a right or wrong answer in this with the data that we have.
Right, I mean, I think the other issue is gilteritinib has a QT issue.
Yes.
Revumenib has a QT issue. So that, and then the other thing I was thinking about is that, I mean, I always think that, like, NPM1 mutations are earlier in the progression of disease than FLT3, but of course you could have a FLT3 clone without the NPM1 mutation. So I really don't know what I'm gonna do. We need more data.
Yeah. When revumenib is, you know, approved, assuming that it will be, how do you see it fitting into your practice in the, you know, front line, possibly in later line?
Yeah, so I'll definitely use it in later line in relapsed and refractory disease. I think there will certainly be centers, you know, in places, you know, like Houston, which will incorporate it immediately into the frontline treatment, maybe even off study. We probably won't do that. Well, I mean, there are studies that are opening with combinations, so I don't think we'll end up doing that off label.
And at MSK, how quickly do you get IDH and NPM1 data back?
Such a good question. So I have been at MSK for 13 years, 3 years as a, 14 years, 3 years as a fellow, and then the rest of the time being an attendant. Mm-hmm. And up until 6 months ago, it took 2.5 weeks to get the results. But finally, our pathology colleagues came up with a rapid NGS assay that gets us the data within 3 to 5 days. Mm-hmm. For NPM1, IDH1, IDH2, FLT3, and then a few other things. Yeah. What do you guys do?
We have an in-house PCR for FLT3, ITD, and PM1.
That's it.
No, we have the P53 we get pretty quickly. But IDH, we don't have in-house NGS yet, so we send it out. You know, depending
so
on
the
company.
You send it to a...
we send it either to NeoGenomics or Foundation.
And how long does that take to get back?
You know, I have to say the turnaround, am I allowed to talk about these companies at this session?
Yeah, I don't think there's barely anyone here.
I know it's being recorded, but NGS is about 2 weeks, or sorry, NeoGenomics is about 2 weeks. Foundation, they've actually been a bit faster, so even like 10 days sometimes. Yeah, well. But still, if we're going to use IDH inhibitors up front, you need it right away. You're not going to leave somebody in the hospital waiting for 10 days.
And do you treat all your azaven and azaivos inpatient, or do you do it outpatient?
No, patient-dependent. So we get a lot of patients through the ED rather than, you know, referrals. Yeah. We do get referrals as well, or patients who are followed by benign heme and have a diagnosis. But for patients who are admitted through the ED, we'll usually do the first cycle inpatient. And then other patients, I think my practice is, it depends on the burden of disease and how likely I think they are to develop TLS, how robust they are. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I know MD Anderson does most inpatient, but I think that might also be because people travel there.
I think they also have more space. I don't think they're under, I mean, I know that our hospital, we're under enormous pressure we never have beds.
The Houston real estate market is a little more forgiving.
Texas is big.
Yeah. They have a lot of space. Yeah.
Okay, one more question. We're going to be over time in a second, about menin inhibitors. If revumenib is approved, would you, in a patient who has KMT2A rearranged patient, relapse refractory. You give them revumenib for relapse disease, they go into remission, they have an allogeneic stem cell transplant. Would you think about restarting revumenib as a maintenance therapy post-transplant?
Yes.
Okay, yes?
I think the decision usually ends up with our transplant colleagues, and I think I could determine based on which transplanter I refer the patient to who will continue it. But I think it's such a high-risk disease, I would probably continue it as long as they're tolerating.
Thanks for listening to this PERspectives podcast. If you would like to receive CE credit for participating in this program, visit our podcast page on our website at gotoper.com. Find the name of this program and click on the link for the post-test. If you like today's episode, please consider subscribing to our podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, Amazon Music, and many of your other favorite podcast platforms. While you're there, please take a moment to rate us. Thanks again for listening.